Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Professor Denny Rancourt. Denny is a distinguished tenured professor of physics. He's a recognized expert in his field. He's also an environmental science researcher, and he taught at the University of Ottawa. They didn't treat him well. For somebody who is such a distinguished man, who stands up so stalwartly for what's right, who's so renowned in his field, two fields, physics and environmental science. Well, you know, when governments are run by rogues, sometimes universities are run by the same types. And the University of Ottawa very much is that way because a former government rogue became president of the university. And Denny hasn't had a moment peace since. This stuff goes on in America, goes on in Canada, goes on in other places. It's pretty outrageous. Denny, welcome to the program. We're going to cover a lot of ground. Let's start. We want to talk about your situation, and you can up me on things that are going on. We've talked about it before on the program, and you can update me on events that have happened since. Let's just begin a little bit.
It's a pleasure to be here, Stephen. I really enjoy coming onto your show and talking about things. I thought we'd start with the UN vote on Gaza.
That is
such an important current development that I thought we'd start there because it's something that I, even though I'm very busy with my battles, I had to look into it and I had to, you know, learn about what has happened recently and the reaction of both the United States and Canada to this vote, which I find abominable. It's just incredible, isn't it?
Let me just mention one thing. There were 9 countries that voted against it, 138, 4, 41 abstentions. Of the 9, only 5 mattered. 4 were small Pacific islands that always go along with America and Israel. They wouldn't dare do otherwise. You know,
right.
I mean, America could blow them out of existence without even firing a shot. They're so tiny. Well, anyway, you get the idea. But of the 5, Canada and America and Israel were 3 of the 5.
Yes, it's despicable. And Panama.
Panama
is a puppet regime of the United States.
Oh, it sure is. The Czech Republic, I don't know what their issue is, but they were the 5th one.
Yeah. Well, anyway, what really shocked me was Canada's and the U.S.'s reaction to this. You know, they're saying it's a threat to peace and to peace negotiations. How absurd is that? The most important, the largest democratic body on the planet, almost unanimously votes for something that is just, and that is seen as a threat by the nation that claims it is defending and promoting democracy in the world. It's just obscene. The logic is perverse, don't you think?
Oh, there's no question about it. There's no question about it. And there's a lot. Even good people misreported exactly what's going on and what it means and what will follow. Headlines the morning after, Denny, were, UN votes for Palestinian statehood. They did no such thing.
Right.
I've said it a number of times in this program. I've written about it a number of times, and I quoted the expert because he was the one responsible for the fact that on November 15th, 1988, Palestine declared its independence. It is a sovereign state. And I'm talking about law professor Francis Boyle, who's been on this program. I know him well, like you, Denny. He's a friend. And I even emailed him after the UN vote, and I said, What's going on? Even good people, Francis, simply don't understand that Palestine already is a state. And even though he emailed me, I could see him shaking his head in agreement, saying, yeah, that's the way these people talk about these things. They don't know anything. Even the ones who are decent people and they should know better, they get it wrong. The issue was to upgrade Palestine's status, and there's a lot more involved that should have happened that didn't.
Sure, but it's a progressive thing, and they're fighting the big boys, and they're doing it slowly and well, and there's a lot of popular support in the sense of many countries, and eventually justice will prevail. I mean, I have to hope that, but the reaction is disgusting and obscene. The U.S. is saying they're going to cut aid, they're going to cut funding, they're going to punish Palestinians for wanting a democratic vote in the largest governing body of the world. It just makes no sense to punish them and to argue that this is an impediment to peace, because the only way to peace, they claim, is through bilateral negotiations where you have a very weak, imprisoned party negotiating with the most powerful player in the region, backed by the most powerful player on the planet. That they're calling that a negotiation. They're not calling it an arm twisting. They're not calling it, a bulldozer flattening the land. They're calling it a negotiation, and they say that negotiation, without anyone else intervening to make sure that it's a little bit more just and a little bit more balanced, that is the only road to peace. And what they really mean is that's the only road to Israel and the U.S. getting everything that it wants. And that's what they're calling peace. So they want unequal negotiation, unequal negotiating parties, one massively stronger and more influential than the other, the other completely disarmed and at the mercy of the strong side, and they're calling that a negotiation. There should be a law against using words in that way. It's so different from their actual meaning. So that's what they want. So if there's a little bit of support to balance things out, they consider it a threat, a democratic vote to express opinion that Palestine should be treated a little bit more fairly, is a threat, Stephen. It's a threat, a massive threat to the whole system, where you have to start cutting funding, increasing the blockade, build more settlements as a response to this aggressive attack of a threat. This is the kind of language that you get from the commentators for Israel and the U.S. It's just out of this world. It's like a kind of nightmare that you can't get out of, you know, to hear this kind of language so different and so distant from actual reality. Unbelievable.
It really is, and the notion that Israel faces a threat by anybody is absolutely nonsensical. Israel, by far, is the military juggernaut of the region. It's nuclear-powered. It has all the modern technology and weapons and munitions. It's got Big Brother Washington backing it up. It's got NATO backing it up. Israel really is an unofficial NATO member without actually being a member. It may be a partner country. I'm not sure. There are a lot of partner countries. The 28 NATO members matter most, and they all have to come to the defense of another one if that one is attacked. But Israel has all the big power boys backing it up. And the idea that some minor force anywhere in the region would threaten Israel is absolutely
crazy. Well,
you know,
they've actually spelled out what the threat is that they're most concerned about, because this new status at the UN for Gaza gives Gaza the right to make complaints to the International Criminal Court.
Oh, yeah.
Now, which territory or which people on the planet has legitimate complaints to make to the International Criminal Court? Name a few. Gaza comes to mind. And so now they're entitled to do exactly that. Now, that is freaking out the United States and Canada. And they consider that a threat. Now, get this. It's a threat that you have a right to go to a court of justice to ask for a determination as to whether or not there were crimes against you, crimes against humanity, war crimes, and so on. It's a threat to want to go to a court of justice to get a determination. That's the logic that we're hearing from the U.S. and Canada. That is a major threat that is, purposefully harming so-called peace negotiations. I mean, what kind of sophistry is that? What kind of a world do we live in where people can actually say this in public and not be laughed off the internet, not be laughed out of town? They actually say this. I'm sorry, Steve. I'm going to say it this way. They actually say this shit with a straight face.
It really is too dim.
And the mainstream media nod up and down and say, and they report this stuff. It's unbelievable. Like, What mad world are we living in where you can say that kind of crap?
It turns logic on its head. The idea that somebody would want to get justice in a court, I mean, that's looked at as an act of terrorism.
Yes.
But a couple,
it's an attack. They're calling it an attack. The possibility that they might do that, to have acquired the possibility that they might be able to go to a court of justice, is an attack and is threatening peace. My God! Hello!
Yes. Indeed. Let me just clarify a couple of points. There are two international courts, at least two I know of, that Palestine could go to. One is the ICC, the International Criminal Court. In that court, you sue, you bring charges against individuals, officials of the government. They could be military officials, they could be government officials, and then you've got the International Court of Justice. It's easy to get the two of them mixed up, and once in a while I've got to check to be sure I'm talking about the right court. The ICJ, you can sue governments. So Palestine can sue Israel in the ICJ, and they can sue Netanyahu and military commanders and other government officials in the ICC. Well, the threat isn't that anything will happen to the state of Israel or to these people. The threat is the symbolism that anybody would have the chutzpah to go to these courts and actually do it.
Exactly.
And it would be hard for even the media to ignore it. You know, they could downplay it, they could poo-poo it, they could do anything they want, but it's pretty tough to ignore. The bottom line is, nothing whatsoever will happen for certain at the ICC, because it only goes after the victims, not the perpetrators. The ICJ, I don't know. Back in the 1980s, during the Contra Wars, the government of Nicaragua, the Sandinista government of Nicaragua, won a judgment against America, a multi-billion dollar judgment in the ICJ. I think it was multi-billion. It was at least a billion. I think it was more than a billion in the ICJ. But Washington just laughed it off and did nothing. Nicaragua never collected 10 cents. But the symbolism of that a world court would assess Washington a massive fine for crimes, I think it was for blockading Nicaragua in the 1980s. I mean, I still remember that, and I've written about it. It's been a while. That could happen to Israel.
Yes. Yeah. The symbolism is powerful. And it's not just symbolism for the rest of the world. It actually eats away at Israel's and America's self-image, which they like to have about themselves, that they're democratic societies, that their regimes are somehow related to justice and fairness and so on. It eats away at the self-image that the leaders of these states like to have. So it in that sense, it does attack them. It attacks them in their self-pride and in their egos and in the talk that they like to have. It attacks them in all those ways, and that hurts, you know. That hurts when if you're a murderer but you like to say that you're not a murderer, that you're a good person, and people point out that you are and it gets publicized, well, that hurts. And I'm sorry if that hurts, but it's not an attack. It's what's called justice. And it's arising now through a democratic process. Hello, that's the democracy that you've been saying you want to promote. I don't know. How can the media report this stuff without pointing out these egregious sophistries that are being spewed out by the American political elite and the spokespersons for Israel? How can the media just go along with it and repeat it? That means that the media, the mainstream media, they're lapdogs. That's all they are. Let's not pretend anything else. This is a clear case. They're not even pointing these things out. They're complete lapdogs.
Well, they sure are, Danny. I spent a fair amount of my time doing media critiques. And by now, I'm sure the New York Times knows about me. They're my favorite target because they probably are the most influential global newspaper. And lots of the stuff that makes their front page ends up on television, ends up in other publications, and it circulates around the world. So they're my favorite target. And the Washington Post is an influential paper, and they're right there in the heart of the beast, the heart of the political beast in Washington. So I go after them a lot. And then selectively, I'll take others on. I mean, I'll bash Rupert Murdoch, I'll bash U.S. television, National Public Radio, public broadcasting, the BBC. I'm an equal opportunity basher, Denny. I mean, they need to be bashed.
I should pay more attention to the New York Times, and I can connect that to my story because, as you introduced me at the beginning of the show, I was fired from my tenured full professorship at the University of Ottawa. And at that time, I've been doing access to information requests, and I'm involved in various legal battles. And as a result, I get disclosures of documents every once in a while. It's like pulling teeth trying to get these documents, but I do get them every once in a while. And there's one document where the president of the university, Alan Rock, is complaining about one of your articles about me, where he's saying it's all lies and the world should know that I'm nothing like what you describe, and so on. And he's asking the another fellow who's now dean of the law school, his name is Feldthusand, he's asking this guy, Feldthusand, how do we get the word out? How do we get the truth out? How can we make it, put it into the media, basically, is what it means, that Roncourt is nothing like what this guy Stephen Lenman is saying, but is in fact a horrible person, and so on. And so they're talking about this in email exchanges, you see.
Denny, I thought you were going to say he talked to this law professor and asked him, how can we get Lenman?
No, they were thinking more, they weren't thinking of how to get you or how to shut you up. They wanted
to discredit me.
They didn't want to attack you. They wanted to counter your message with a message that was negative in my regard. And they wanted to do it as you know, in a big way. And as they were exchanging about this, this guy, Feldthusand, says, well, I'll talk to someone called Yael, which I presume, you know, I don't know what nationality a name like that would be, but they're going to talk to Yael, and they're going to explore who they can talk to. And you know, Alan Rock is going to do the same on his side. That's what you presume from this email. And then, by surprise, there's a story in the New York Times that comes out about me, and it's by Stanley Fish. Now, I don't know what you know about Stanley Fish.
No, I don't know him.
Oh, well, he's supposedly a big shot in the academic world, but he's clearly a Zionist. He's clearly completely pro-Israel state-wise policies, agenda, everything, right? And they get this guy, Stanley Fish, who has a regular column in the New York Times, and Fish bashes me in a large column. Like, who am I, this little professor in Canada? Stanley Fish of the New York Times all of a sudden decides to bash me just after Alan Rock, who is a heavyweight in the Canadian government, who is a known Zionist by all his positions and what he's done at the UN, how he changed Canada's vote under his, when he was an ambassador to the UN, Alan Rock, that's when Canada started voting against human rights resolutions at the UN for Palestine. They had traditionally voted, abstained, and all of a sudden they're voting against it. So that happened under Alan Rock. Now, so Stanley Fish writes this article. Now, you'd think that one major column about a small university professor in the New York Times would be enough to do the job. Well, if you read that first column, it actually is not that negative against me. He kind of finds me spunky, and is kind of impressed by the way that I resist and stand up. You can read that between the lines, even though he's being highly critical of my position on pedagogy and so on, and trying to reduce my reputation as a university professor, you can still see that he's got some admiration for me in that column. So that wasn't good enough. So he had, for some reason, he wrote a second column about me in the New York Times. There were two columns, one after the other, one that followed the other not too long, and the second one was highly negative of me, over the top negative of me, and the horrible things that I had done in my teaching and so on. Well, this, I don't know, I look at the chronology, I look at the ideological connections between these people, and I wonder out loud, does Alan Rock have a connection to Stanley Fish? Did they communicate directly or indirectly? Are the New York Times columns bashing me a response to the articles of Stephen Lendman? Do you see what I'm saying, Steve?
Oh, indeed.
And if I had to, you know, if I was a historian trying to reconstruct events, I would say, well, it's likely that this is what's going on here, you see?
Jenny, I wanted to say, when this came out in the New York Times, if there really was an easily seen connection to me, I wish you alerted me at the time because I
would have
been
No, they would never have mentioned you, Stephen. That they would never have mentioned you. They would never draw attention to your work. The purpose was to make sure that my image and my reputation was bashed in response to your positive articles about me. That was the purpose, you see. And I didn't know this connection until I got these document disclosures. I wasn't able to put together the chronology and figure out why is Stanley Fish, you know, this hotshot, highly recognized, in quotations, academic, writing about me in the New York Times, like what's going on here, right? Because the University of Ottawa purports to not liking how I graded students in one class and are using that as a pretext to fire me, why is that a story that's been featured twice in full columns in the New York Times? You know, try and figure it out. And this is the chronology that I've been able to piece together. It's a theory of what might have happened, you see.
Well, very interesting.
I mean, the
idea that maybe I could be hinted at, without mention, but maybe hinted at, or at least perhaps the cause, or the inspiration
for
a New York Times
article. I would say the cause, but there'd be no hint about it. There'd be that you know, they're clever, and they know how to bash someone without drawing attention to someone else who disagrees with them.
No, I understand. I changed the wording to inspiration. That the idea really was focusing on you, and maybe I was the inspiration for a New York Times article.
Yes, I think you were. I think your work was the inspiration. I think that's a good way to put it. And,
maybe I should write a thank you letter to the editor.
Yeah. Well, you could write to Stanley Fish and say, you know, it looks like the reason someone may have contacted you, if they did, would have been my writings about Denis Rancourt, you know.
What I should really say to him is, if you really wanted the scoop on the inspirer of your article, why don't you go to the source and I'll answer any questions you may have.
Right. Or he could have gone to me.
Why didn't
Stanley Fish call me or contact me before he wrote these two, especially the second one, just this egregiously and factually incorrect article about me?
The problem with doing that, Denny, is he wouldn't do it, but there would be a greater reason for him to actually tell the story right instead of the way he presented it.
Oh, it would constrain him to some degree to the truth, and so he wouldn't be able to write it how he wants to write it. So I don't think he's going to contact me, you know.
No, and he won't contact me either.
Even if I was a columnist, as part of my research, if I'm targeting someone, I would give them a call and I would have a chat with them, a nice long chat. You know, that's what I would do as a columnist for the New York Times. I mean, as a blogger, I don't always do it. I go from the evidence I have and I give my opinion. But if my opinion is highly negative towards someone or is highly critical, then I write to them and I say, look, I've written this, and I give them an opportunity to make factual corrections or comment on it or post comments to the blog or write another article that would be featured on the same blog. I always do that, you know. But this guy, Stanley Fish, there was none of that, none of it.
Well, a good reporter, Danny, is somebody who is supposed to go out and get the facts and then write the story accordingly. If you only get the facts that you want to get and you ignore the ones that you don't want to get, that is not journalism. That is propaganda. And it's also vilification, bashing, bashing when they want to beat up on someone.
Column opinion, right? That's how they see it. But ask yourself, why was this an important story, and why did it, if it was such an important story, why was it not important to get the facts straight and to look at all the angles of it before you go off and write two columns in the New York Times about it? What was motivating you? Did someone suggest this would be a good story? It'd be interesting to find those things out.
Oh, he was told to do this. He was told to do it.
He suggested it would be good for mutual interest if he did this or something. I don't think he was told to do it.
I can remember when I jumped on your story the first time. It's such an important issue to me. I've written about dozens of people that have been wrongly maligned because they pray to the wrong God. I'm talking about Muslim people, and the bogus war on terror that was declared after 9/11, and so many innocent people have been harmed. I focus mostly on Americans, but I've written about Palestinians in the territories. I've written about a few Canadians, at least one other one. Kelly is. I wrote about him.
Mark Kelly,
your student. Mark Kelly, your student. I forget the other fellow's name, the Canadian, and his wife Sophie.
Oh yes, Harkat, Sophie Harkat.
Yes, I wrote about
Mohammed
him.
Harkat. Yes.
You know him.
Yes. I mean, I've met him and shaked his hand and had a chat or two with him at various public events and so on. Yes.
His struggle still continues, and there was another academic, and I can't think of his name, in Canada, who I wrote about, and I think his travails still persist. I think the issue for him is to send him to a country where he would be terribly repressed, I think, if they managed to get him there. And the last I heard, that has not happened, but he's terribly concerned about that. And all the underlying theme of every single one of these people that I write about is not a single one did anything that violated any law in any sense of the word. And so many of these people, like you, Denny, were distinguished people or did heroic things in one way or another. I remember Sami Alarian, the Muslim professor from South Florida University, and he was so badly maligned. And there's only one person I know I wrote about who actually got out of prison. And I spoke to him on the telephone. He lives in the Los Angeles area. But his travail may still persist, because I think that there are plans afoot possibly to try to deport him. And he did absolutely nothing. But they punished these people so badly in detention or imprisonment. I mean, they literally put them through torture or something that pretty much is close to it. It's not very far from what goes on at Guantanamo. And I wrote about the stuff that I learned in graphic detail of these people in detention. I wrote about it. I wrote about the people at Guantanamo, but I wrote about others. And I feel like I got to know these people. I wrote about my friend Lynn Stewart, a very distinguished human rights lawyer. She was sentenced to 10 years in prison because she defended the wrong client.
Right.
That's the kind of stuff that goes on.
I can hear the theme music coming on, which means we're going to have a break soon,
We're going to take a short break.
Okay, I'd like to say a few words about Guantanamo.
Oh, indeed. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Onward, Denny Rancourt. Denny, you brought up Guantanamo, and that festering sore is still with us. It was an abomination, not when it opened, but when the idea was conceived to build it and open it, and it remains, and it really is disgusting. It doesn't get much coverage in the mainstream.
A lot of people who had done nothing wrong except be themselves or be brave and speak to justice, and they end up in places like that, and they end up in prison, they end up in a lot of places. Well, I just want to say that I think I'm one of those brave persons that puts forth all kinds of opinions about where there are injustices and things like that. I did not go to prison, but I went to a kind of prison, which is that I was fired from my position as professor. I was barred from my students. I was barred from my own graduate students, from my own laboratory, from my work, from my profession. And I was trespassed and barred from campus itself. I was accompanied off campus by police when I came back because I was hosting a Cinema Politica evening discussion night, which I'd been doing for many years. I was arrested, handcuffed, and dragged off campus to the police station because supposedly I'd been trespassed. This was while I was still a full and tenured professor at the University of Ottawa. And that has continued, and it's taken years, and we're still before the courts regarding my dismissal, which my union is saying was a wrongful dismissal done in bad faith, and it's taking forever. And at the same time, the university is now funding a private defamation litigation against me. And you know about that, and that litigation is aggressive. They're suing me for $1 million for comments, for criticisms I made of a law professor who's in the same faculty where this fellow Feltusen that I mentioned earlier is the dean. And it's a very aggressive lawsuit, and I'm defending myself, and I'm defending myself against two of the largest law firms in Canada. I'm learning the law. I'm doing the best I can. And recently, I asked the judge to recuse himself because I argued I needed to be able to make a motion that there was a reasonable apprehension of bias regarding him because the action involves the University of Ottawa, and he has funded a scholarship at the University of Ottawa in the Faculty of Law in the name of his deceased son. In addition to that, his deceased son was a lawyer at the big law firm, BLG, which is representing the university. And when the son died, the BLG law firm named a boardroom after the son. So here's the judge who says in the media that this boardroom naming and this scholarship are very important to him because it's important to him to preserve the memory of his son and so on. He's expressing this publicly. And I say, well, given that you cling to these things and therefore cling to the scholarship endowment fund, and since that is related to the reputation of the university, and since my legal actions against the university for funding the lawsuit against me also is related to the reputation of the university, because I'm saying that it's a champertist, that it's a legal funding, it's an illegal funding, and therefore, the ruling could tarnish the reputation of the university, which would obviously potentially have an impact on scholarships and so on. And I'm saying that if you cling to a boardroom being named with your son's name on it, that you're going to have, it's going to be perceived that you might have a tendency to rule in cases in the direction of the law firm in order to, because you have an emotional tie to that law firm. I'm saying that there's a perception of that. So I was telling the judge, I think that the outside world would perceive that there's a bias here. Now, if it can be established that the outside world, a reasonable observer, would perceive that, then the judge has to recuse himself. Well, the judge did nothing of the sort. He recused himself, but he claimed he was recusing himself because I had dared to bring up the topics of his son's death in relation to this scholarship and to the boardroom being named after him, but that he was not recusing himself on a bias question. So I said, well, I went to court and I said, well, I need a judicial determination of this question of reasonable apprehension of bias because I'm entitled to a determination, and if it is found that there is such a reasonable apprehension of bias, then the law says that all the rulings of that judge cannot stand and must be basically annihilated. So I made what is called a leave to appeal to get this judicial determination eventually by going to appeal. And I just got the ruling yesterday or the day before from this leave to appeal. And the judge found that it's a clear case where he sees absolutely no possibility of a reasonable person finding that there's a reason to apprehend bias in these circumstances. That was the rule that just came out. Okay? Now, because I lost that ruling, I'll be paying costs. And there, I've been paying costs on all these motions where I'm trying to defend myself, and it's tens of thousands of dollars. They've completely financially ruined me. These rulings against me on costs have emptied out my savings, my life savings. And I'm at a point now where I'm just trying to get enough money to be able to file in court the documents I need to file to defend myself. And I'm having a hard time doing that, which is why I started a legal fund, the Rancourt Legal Fund. So if your listeners want to help out and want to keep someone who's fighting for his rights alive in the courts, paying the fees to file documents, paying the fees to produce documents that must be produced, just the photocopying and binding and things like that, cost hundreds and hundreds of dollars every time you want to file all the documents you need, then listeners can go, and I hope you don't mind me saying this on your show, Stephen.
Eddie, let me interrupt you one second.
Okay.
This is very important to me that you are saying it. We did this the last time you came on. There were very generous listeners who came to who really wanted to help, and they did help. And it's important that people who have gone through such gross injustice as you, it's not just the fact that somebody is being treated unjustly, it's that somebody of your eminence, your distinction, has been targeted literally because you did the right thing. It wasn't because you crossed somebody and you did something you shouldn't have done. You did the right thing. You stood up for the right things. You acted honorably, and because of that, they targeted you, and they fired you, and they persecuted you, and everybody in a situation like that deserves help. You absolutely deserve help. Tell listeners how they can contact you easily and make any contribution, a small one, a larger one if they can afford it, anything they could do to help for the right cause, for the right thing.
Now, people have been generous, and there have been lots of people who have sent in donations, but I have to tell you that this litigation is extremely expensive. It's worth the fight because it forces the system to be fair, and it forces the system eventually, I think, to give rulings that will be just. But you can't give up, and you have to go ahead. And the funds that people have sent in so far are spent. In fact, they're overspent. They're more than overspent. So, and I'm not hiring a lawyer. I'm self-defended. I wouldn't give money to a lawyer unless I absolutely need to get a very specific legal opinion. But so it would very much help if people could send more donations in. And the easiest way, I think, would be to go to one of my blogs. I mean, you can find my blogs easily enough by just Googling my name, you know, Denis, it's like Dennis with one N, and then Rancourt. Or you can go to one of my blogs, which is called Activist Teacher. So that's all one word, activistteacher.blogspot.ca. And the front page there, you've got my picture, and just above my head in the picture on the right, there's a link that's called Donate to the Denis Rancourt Legal Fund. And if you click on that, it brings you to a page on a page that's about how to donate. And there's a PayPal button there. You can send a check to an address. You can contact me. There's my email, and it tells you how you can donate. So that's the easiest way. You just go to this blog, activistteacher.blogspot.ca, and it'll bring you right there. where the link to the donate is right above my picture on the right. That would maybe be the easiest way. And I'm hoping that more and more people will join in to contribute, and so that we can join our resources so that I can continue this battle for justice, because there is no justice if you have a large asymmetry in resources, because it's just so expensive that they get you to a point where you can't even defend yourself anymore. You can't even file the documents because the filing fees, you can't pay them. My next motion before the court, which is like a little mini trial, well, not a little mini trial, it's a mini trial, is called the Champerty motion. That's the name we've given it, and it'll be the biggest motion I've done so far, and it basically is accusing the university of a Champertus funding agreement with the plaintiff, that they're doing this to recover funds, because the plaintiff has said if she wins, the law professor that's suing me, I'm arguing by proxy, is doing this by proxy, being funded by the university, has said that if she gets damages, she will give half of the punitive damages back to the university. So we've got the university funding this lawsuit against me, a private defamation lawsuit, to sue a former professor. And then that professor that is suing, that is, in my opinion, the proxy for this lawsuit, is saying, and half of the punitive damages I will put into a scholarship fund in the same faculty that I'm from, at the University of Ottawa. So that is against the law in Ontario, I am arguing. It's called a Champertus funding agreement, where you get some of the proceeds of the action back. So I'm putting forward a big action, this Champerty motion, and just for that action, the legal documents are almost 2,000 pages from me, not counting the other side, just my legal documents that I'm filing to the court, and it's bound into 6 books. So just the cost of copying, binding, putting tabs in the hundreds and hundreds of dollars. And that was just very recently.
So Jenny, I want to emphasize that it's your personal resources against the very deep pockets of the University of Ottawa, and the university is funding the lawsuit by I can only call her a stooge or a stalking horse of a law professor who literally sold her soul to conspire with the university against somebody she should be allied with instead of attacking. She is a shameless law professor, and she teaches human rights and civil rights. I just can't imagine what kind of stuff kids get in her classroom if this is what she does on the outside.
Well, I don't want to comment on that at all, but I do
go
want
after you for
say,
double jeopardy. Maybe she'll take me on. I don't know.
Well, I do want to say though that because I am mounting this legal challenge, the Champerty motion, as a result, I was entitled to disclosures of some documents, and I was entitled to cross-examine the president, Alan Rock, himself. And he said, under oath, when I cross-examined him, that he had personally made the decision to fund this lawsuit against me without a spending limit. He used the term with no cap. So on, without even having read the blog that is complained about in the defamation lawsuit, he made, without having looked at the facts enough to even read the document that's being claimed to be defamatory, the president told this professor, basically agreed that he would fund her legal costs without a spending limit. No conditions other than that were imposed in any way, according to the sworn testimony that I've heard. So that's the situation that we have. You talked about deep pockets. Well, there you go. And the law firms that are involved on their side are two of the largest, probably the two largest law firms in Canada. One is called Gowling's, the other is called BLG. And they're two of the most experienced partners in those two firms are there. Like, for example, the BLG lawyer, one of his recent jobs was to defend the former Prime Minister of Canada in a fraud case and he won for the former prime, one of the former prime ministers of Canada, this fellow named Jean Chrétien. So that was one of his last legal jobs. And now he's representing the university, defending against my Champerty motion. You see, that gives you the kind of scale that we have here, where I'm self-represented, and they have these incredible lawyers and resources. Now, the lawyer that's representing the plaintiff said in court the other day, I was pointing out to the judge that I'm self-represented, therefore there should be some leeway when I make small technical errors. There should be some leeway not to be too picky on little procedural matters and to go for the heart of the matter in terms of justice. And to that, this lawyer responded that I was, that the judge should not take that into account because, according to him, I'm one of the best litigation lawyers in the city. According to him, he screamed that out in court, you know, and he's previously said that my legal documents are of a very high standard, and the judge was saying that my legal arguments were impeccable the last time I was in court, and the previous judge was saying that he's never seen a self-represented litigant able to produce the kinds of high-quality legal submissions that he's seen in my case. Now, he ruled against me, but he still admitted that or was happy to explain that my legal documents were good. And I think my legal arguments are strong, and I think that they should be winning. This is my opinion, but I should be winning these cases. And I don't understand fully why I'm not winning them, but I'm endeavoring to understand, and I will eventually write a book about how it is that you cannot win, even though you're convinced that you should be winning, given the logic and the rigor of your legal arguments. But that's a project for the future if I survive this. So in a nutshell, that's some of the situations that are occurring here.
Again, Danny, this is an appalling situation that absolutely, you know, makes my blood boil. I mean, it's such an outrageous thing to happen. And too few people in America realize just how extremist Canada can be. Not just the government of Canada, with a rogue of a prime minister, Stephen Harper, but Chrétien was no jewel. Canada hasn't had half-decent prime ministers in a very, very long time. And America, I have to scratch my head to think about the good U.S. presidents. There were some that had some redeeming qualities, but certainly weren't very many U.S. presidents that had any redeeming qualities at all, including some of the better-known names.
Well, I have to say that Jean Chrétien, you know, in my voting history as a 55-year-old man, Jean Chrétien was one of the better ones. Now I realize that, you know, since I've seen the ones that have come after him, it's just frightening. But I have to say I have respect for the conservatives that are in power right now, because unlike the liberals that were mainly have been in power in Canada over historic times, they actually say what they think. They're blunt about it. They actually put forward policies that are unambiguous, where they're clear where they're going. And they're just straight up, and I appreciate that. I don't agree with most of what they do, but it's refreshing to have them be straight up and be at least transparent about what their motives are in terms of when you see where they're going with it, you know. Now, they're not being transparent in terms of opening the books and showing where they're at and communicating honestly with the media. They're the opposite of transparent in that regard, but at least you know where they stand. With the liberals, there was a lot more underhanded, despicable backroom. Everything was done in the back rooms. You never knew really that you didn't realize that they actually believed the opposite of what they were putting forward in their image. It takes you decades to figure it out, you know. So, you know, like for example, Stephen Harper is an extreme pro-Zionist. But under the Liberals, it was Alan Rock who stopped abstaining at the UN. regarding these human rights votes in favor of Palestine, and instead started voting against these resolutions. So this was under a liberal government, whereas they were pretending, they were claiming in their talk to be pro-human rights, you see. So at least the conservatives don't go on and on about how they protect human rights.
Well, it's good to at least get people who say what they mean.
Yeah.
At the same time, you know, some of these appalling policies, the support for imperial wars, the one-sided support for Israel, and it is as one-sided as America is for Israel, I think Canada is even more so.
Oh, at the moment, yes. At the moment, under this government, there's no question that Canada is the biggest ally of Israel at the moment. It's in terms of their decision and their rhetoric, Canada is, in practice, a lapdog of Israel. It's almost like the interests of Israel are more important than the interests of Canada. How is it in Canada's interest to be that close and to support Israel in its regional geopolitical aims and in its wars and so on? How is that in the interest of Canada? I can only think of one way that it's in the interest of Canada. And I hope that this is not the reason they're doing it. But it's like this. If you strengthen Israel, because Israel is so into war and so into territorial gains and things like that, it's going to necessarily destabilize the region and increase the price of oil, because the region is a large oil producer, and any destabilization, any warring, any tensions are going to increase the price of oil. Well, Canada has one of the biggest fossil fuel reserves on the planet, the tar sands in Alberta, which is the political Alberta is the political base of this conservative government in Canada. So if you and the tar sands are expensive to exploit. You need high oil prices to be able to make billions from the tar sands. So I can see a connection there, but I'm hoping that it's not, that their reasons are not that devious. I'm hoping that it's just pure stupid ideology that is blind to justice and human rights. But it could also largely be in terms of just crass economic control and power-based dynamics involving finances. You know, that could be part of it as well. So, I don't know.
Denny, we're near the end of the program.
Yeah.
Repeat your websites again for listeners who want to help you and make a contribution.
Well,
that's the way I want to end the program.
If they Google my name, they'll immediately find all kinds of things, and they'll find my blogs, and my two main blogs have a donate button, either PayPal directly or a link in words that says, donate to the Denise Oncle Legal Fund. So the two main websites that you'll blogs that you'll find that have these links are activistteacher.blogspot.com. Activist teacher is all one word, no space, no dot, no dash, nothing. And the other one is U of O Watch as one word. The letter U of O Watch, all one word, .blogspot.com. And that's where I've been very critical of the institution, the University of Ottawa, for many years. And that's the blog that they're suing me over at the moment as well. Yeah.
Well, I just Google your name, and I see activist teacher.
Well, there you go.
Let me spell your name for listeners. It's D-E-N-I-S.
Yes.
R-A-N-C-O-U-R-T.
Yeah.
And if listeners just Google your name, Denny, they will see activist posts. So you've got Wikipedia on top. Activist teacher is below that. They have me as a number three on that.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
Oh, they got me.
I haven't Googled my name for a while.
Well, I've written three articles about you.
Yes, well,
and
that's
if you go down on my front page, I've got U of O Watch, so they can easily find you. Your image is on this page. They can easily find you, Denny, and I urge listeners to do what they can. I would just say emphatically, your cause is more than just You deserve righteousness as much as anybody I know, and I certainly hope that somehow that will come out of this wash in the end. You have been treated so unfairly, so harshly. It's why I've said to you, Denny, and I'd repeat it again and again, that you have an open platform in this program any time that you want to come on to discuss these vital things, because what's happening to you has happened in different ways to so many other people. It really is the grossest of injustice that the big, powerful bullies beat up on the people who don't have the wherewithal to fight back on equal terms. And I like to be on the side of the people who deserve a lot better than that, Denny.
Well, I'm honored at this open invitation from you, Stephen, and I will gladly take you up on it. Maybe there'll be something to tell your listeners after this next round of the legal battle. We'll see.
I'm sure there will be. We want to keep this thing going. And who knows how long this is going to go on, Denny. But it could go on for a while. This legal stuff can go on interminably. But we can discuss this a lot more on this program. And again, it's an open forum for you.
Thank you, Stephen. Thank you,
Denny,
very much.
We'll talk again soon. We have run over the hour. I got to get off the air. Join us again tomorrow, same time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.